I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
What are wine professionals pairing with turkey this Thanksgiving? Here's what a few New York wine people are opening up this month. Chris McPherson is not messing around, and he's going straight for the Grand Cru Burgundy.
Chris, what are you pouring on Thanksgiving?
Pouring for myself some Ligne Vigile. Clos Saint-Denis Grand Cru, 2006 vintage, something a bit special for a special day.
You're not messing around there. You're really living it up.
Well, you know, it's just me and my partner, so she'll enjoy this, and obviously I'll take it a little bit more than she gets.
And you just did a trip to Burgundy, didn't you?
I did. I was lucky enough to have a trip. It was fantastic. We did a lot of barrel sampling, so the Sensodyne toothpaste was very valuable on that trip and was being passed around. Under the table by everyone. But it was fantastic. It was amazing to be there and to meet the people behind, you know, these fantastic, amazing wines that you see in the market.
Now, Victoria James, she has something special in mind for her vegetarian feast.
V, what are you pouring with your turkey?
Well, for my guests, Cru Beaujolais, Le Levant, Diacon, but I'm a vegetarian, so with my Brussels sprouts and sweet potatoes, I'll have white Burgundy all the way, definitely.
Which producer?
Guignard. Le Caire, hands down.
Molly Reitzel, she's getting her Lebanese wine fix this Thanksgiving.
This year for Thanksgiving, Erin, we're going to be drinking the 2003 Chateau Mussard Rouge. It's an amazing vintage. It's drinking perfectly right now. It's nice and rich with that Cabernet synonymous grape that they have, but it also has some Cinsault in it, which gives it a really kind of light aromatic quality. It's delicious, and it's perfect with turkey, stuffing, cranberry, and pumpkin pie.
I think that's something that Serge would approve of.
I agree.
Now, Michael Nelson, he's going straight for the good stuff in Piedmonte.
Amen. What are you drinking with turkey this year?
I'm going Piedmont. Yeah? Pella Varga. Lost grape, but outstanding. Arruque. Tastes like sage. Sage and cranberries.
That's going to go perfect with the turkey.
Perfect. Knockdown, drag out, fight's over, Ruke.
Christy Frank. She still hasn't decided what she's opening up with turkey, but she's ready for dessert.
Yo, gobble, gobble. What am I drinking with the turkey? I know what I'm drinking after the turkey. For the after turkey celebration, we will be drinking the round.
Excuse me, after turkey?
You have your turkey, you have your wine, it's all very proper, blah, blah, blah. Then there's the pumpkin pie and the whipped cream. Round House Pumpkin King Pumpkin Liqueur. It's evil and so good.
Erin Von Rock. He's looking more for a transformative wine experience.
Erin, what are you pouring with turkey this Thanksgiving?
I think you really do Gewürztraminer. You know, it makes sense. It's spice, adventure. And at the end of the night, people are calling it Gewürztraminer, which is a fun transformation in and of itself.
Gewürztraminer to Gewürztraminer, a fun transformation. Matt Conway is going large format and for something he doesn't normally drink.
What are you pouring with your turkey this year?
A really, really big bottle of Beaujolais.
How big is the bottle?
Hopefully 3-5 liters of La Paix Beaujolais. And I hate Beaujolais, but I'll do it with turkey.
Shit, I can't believe you just said that. You just said I hate Beaujolais. What about the Crus? You don't like those Crus?
Nope, sorry.
What about Fleury?
Done.
JT Robertson, he's keeping it simple.
What am I pouring with my turkey this evening? Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. In the liter format, which is beautiful, right? It's 5% alcohol.
You really taste it in that liter.
No, it's better. It ages better.
It ages much better.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So then you pair that with the bacon cheeseburger from Wendy's. Do you know Wendy's?
Let me ask you this: what are you really drinking with your turkey?
What am I really drinking with my turkey?
What are you opening up?
Savuto, Odiari Savuto. It's a Galliopio blend from, I'm serious, from Liguria. It's fine.
From Liguria?
Yeah.
But what, pray tell, is legendary David Newlin pulling from his weathered doctor's bag this Thanksgiving? An answer to all our burning questions
Oh, yeah, let me ask you this. What are you drinking with your turkey? Don't lie now. I really want to know the exact bottle you're going to open up on Thanksgiving.
I'm going to be in Paris, so I'm going to drink.
Are you
going to
be at your house in Paris?
I'm going to be at my home in Paris. So I'm going to be drinking, since I'm in Paris, Pepe Van Winkle with my turkey, because I'm very patriotic.
You're going to be drinking Gentleman Jack.
Gentleman Jack in my patriotic zest for my homeland.
David Newland, drinking American drinks on Thanksgiving. Now, I also talked with another sommelier, but his answer was so intricate that it warrants its own segment. So stay tuned next week to find out who. And I'm going to give you a little teaser here. We may or may not be singing an impromptu drinking song in perfect harmony.
I'm Molly from Public Restaurant, and I use 750 all the time. It has all of the information I could possibly need. It makes my life so much easier, and it's one of the best reference tools I have. I love 750.com.
Frank Cornelison here from Sicily. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello, I'm fine.
Nice to see you. You're from Belgium.
Yes.
And your dad was a wine collector.
Yes. My mother was a director of the hotel school in my home village, which is Hasselt. And every Sunday was kind of a family gathering, because both parents obviously are busy with their work. And so Sunday was a sacred moment for the four of us, with my sister to be together. And so I was usually plummeting in the cellar with my father to go and check the right bottle for the right dish, which my mother was preparing.
Your dad collected wine, and you used to open bottles with him.
Yes, and the collecting started at a later age, because the wine drinking, the wine tasting, I think I started at 8 or 10 years old. And then the real collecting, together with my father, and from my age, started as of the age of 14. I remember very well. I was able to buy a mixed case of DRC 72. My father bought one, and I bought one. And so we gradually, over the years, we finished them both. We were not really collectors for the money, but collectors for the drinking.
So you get a little bit older, and you moved into consulting and brokering.
Yes, and that was a long, percorso in Italiano. It has taken a bit of time, a few years, because I honestly was afraid to make a professional life out of wine, because it takes away a part of the freedom to choose, because you sometimes have to make, business or economical choices. And so I found a nice way to avoid this and to be able to purchase old cellars and to sell them abroad or to other wine passionate people. And so there was, only the availability of special wines, let's call them stock market wines, labels. And those have also given me the possibility to taste, the world's, well, let's put it this way, not really the world's at that moment, but especially France's and Grand Crus and great wines.
So an earlier generation of Frank, you were drinking a lot of the classics,
yes,
of France.
Yes, because also, I was born in 61, so by the time I was 14, I was drinking the 70s, mid-70s, up to mid-80s Bordeaux's. And I remember very well in those days, and the top growths, you could buy them per bottle from the shelves, and at very reasonable prices. And converted, they were costing 25, 30 euro. And we're talking about Petrus, Ikem, Lafitte, and Mouton, Margaux, all the top chateaus.
And at what point did you decide that maybe I'd like to make my own wine?
Also that is quite a complex story. There's not one specific reason why someone would go to go and make wine, but it is a combination, I think, for the love of nature. And I was doing a lot of alpine climbing, which means adventure, the sports and activity, the challenges, and so everything combined, and with my, let's say, gastronomic background and the love for wine, has driven me a bit more to the productive side than for example just the buying and the selling and the analytical tasting side. And so gradually I grew into I was getting much more attracted to the producing. And so when I was visiting the wineries, I was always asking the why question, why this, why that. And so I got much more attracted every year, and I was more and more, involved, and my passion grew for wine.
You decide to go to Etna, and why was that?
There was no sudden flash for going to Etna. There was no immediate search for Etna. It has been a gradual process of eliminating places where I did not want to go to for a number of reasons. And mainly it was either I didn't want to go to, for example, Burgundy because it has become a monoculture. The same thing for Barolo, although I love Nebbiolo. I couldn't find the right, environmental and complexity anymore. And so I was more intrigued also with the fact of being able to plant and without grafted vines, so the ungrafted vines, which means I had to step away from limestone or even clay. And so I ended up with a sandy structure. And then looking and digging into the geological part of the wines, I ended up checking out the volcanoes, which means Vesuvius and Etna, and so they were on the list of places to check out. And in 2000, I went to Georgia, the Caucasus, which has been a beautiful and a trip also, and a very adventurous, because it was going back to the roots of winemaking. And after this trip, and I came to Etna, I visited a friend in Vittoria, Giusto Chipinti, and with him we had a bottle, and which was a surprise, and served by a sommelier in Modica. And it was an Etna wine afterwards, and so we couldn't really place the wine. We were thinking about maybe north of Italy, Piemonte. And then when the wine was and the bottle was undiscovered, and it was unbelievable to see that it was Etna. And so the next day I took the car, I drove out there, but there was not enough time to find the place. It was a complicated and a trip to find all the small locations, the villages. And driving into the valley, I remember it struck me, because I had the impression that it was like a déjà vu of Georgia, the whole environment. It was still snow on the mountain, the stone walls, old vines, and it was like love at first sight. And then when I was talking with a local and a producer and a local person, explained me that he was making his own wine, and I didn't understand everything because it was a bit dialect and Sicilian, and so it was a bit complicated. But then he explained me that he was harvesting very late, like in October, at least for me, that seemed very late. And so putting bits and pieces of information together of that trip, I just decided like that's the place. And so I, after a few months, I came back and to check the place out in a more profound way. And I found a small place to start my, my winery, in which was half a hectare, and not even that, with a small old cellar. We took out the barrels and put in amphoras, and that's how the whole story took off, without even knowing the logistics or the all the mechanisms of a winery or the winemaking, and which was much more complicated.
And about what year was that?
That was 2001. I came back in December 2000. 2001, I started pruning the vineyard together with with the person who was living above the cellar. His father was it's called a contadino, and he taught me how to prune, how to work the land, and so it's it's a bit of a fantastic story, because nothing of that came from a balance sheet or some kind of projection for to make a winery. It was just, the idea was to produce wine, not to set up a winery. That was the last thing that was planned, and so it was more like a hobby operation, which grew out of hand and has become a winery now.
So you started with half a hectare, and you had some pre-phylloxera vines in there.
We had a part of pre-phylloxera vines, vines that were old but grafted, and it was a mix of everything. Let's say the original vineyards, half of the vines were, I think, over the years they died, and they were replaced with grafted ones, and because that was, let's say, standard procedure and from the new period. But there were really incredibly old vines in that plot.
And you decided to do skin contact, and you'd also installed some clay vessels.
Well, yes and no. It was not that simple. The intellectual process of how to make the wine had been, let's say, already formed, or the idea was already clear. And the skin contact, yes, because biologics, all the flavors are on the skins, and so I wanted, let's say, the most skin contact which I could get. So my idea was not just to have skin contact during alcoholic fermentation, but also an malolactic fermentation. The clay vessels, for me at that time when I started, seemed logic, because I did not want any external taste going into the wine. My idea of wine was on a liquid rock, and so I did not want any wood or any other taste going into that wine. And so the clay vessels were the perfect, at that time, answer to to what I was looking for. And so I found these vessels in Spain. They were smaller than the Georgian ones, which were, I think, about 2,000 liters, the content, and the Spanish ones were 400, which fitted better for, let's say, the size of the vineyard I had at that time.
And did Guisto point you to those? Because he ended up using Spanish amphora.
Yes, I had a truck coming with the amphora. I brought two amphoras to Guisto, and he did some testing with it. I started also with this, and Guisto liked it. And then afterwards, he bought quite a lot of the amphoras for his Pitos wines. And I continued with the ones I had, and I must say the first batch of the amphoras was very good. The clay was very dense. The second one that arrived the year afterwards, and I was very disappointed, because they lost a lot of liquid because the clay was not baked possibly at the right temperature, or the quality of the clay was too coarse grain, and I had a loss of liquid. And so that I did not use them for 3 or 4 years afterwards. And after that period, when I found out that also the lined epoxy lining was gave better results in terms of wine, I started to use also the second battery, which arrived, but completely lined.
You had started with the idea of having liquid rock, and so something from the earth,
yeah,
would have helped you along with that, but you had problems involving evaporation and losing liquid,
exactly,
and then oxidation maybe as well.
Exactly. The idea of liquid rock, let's step back and from the beginning. And the first 2 years, I think, were much more an anti-wine, in a way, that I started the idea to produce a wine which was not an Australian, let's say, fruit bomb, not an, a concentrated an, wood wine. And so the ideas were more not this and not that, and which means a bit more of a provocative and concept, more based on what I did not like, much more than what I maybe would have liked. And but as I did not even know what the territory and was going to be like, and my concept was more based on the on, let's say, the things I prefer to avoid than I prefer to achieve, and then because that was still a question mark. And so gradually in 2001 were very evolved wines and oxidized and but not dead, and they are very alive, but the colors, they completely changed from red or the orange say tuyer, the brick color, to nearly black ash, and which was actually quite funny, because working on black lava soil, it's like the wine literally and visually and was liquid rock in a way. And so I still like those wines. They still have an edge. They have a tension, but obviously they miss a fruitiness, an approachability. And so I call this I like to refer to the to this these first, let's say, 3 years as intellectual wines, which gradually moved to a search for, let's say, at first not precision, but a bit more fruit, and a wine that has a hedonistic pleasure to drink, with an identity of territory, which after 4 years I was trying to I was starting to understand what Etna wines were and were meant to me, the tannins, but also the glycerin from the south, the elegance, but also the density of the wines and the profoundness. That has taken time, and so I accept criticism when people say, like, okay, your wines are oxidized, but I also cannot hide the fact that those are my children, and I still like them, and on cold winter days those wines they still touch me, and they give me a sense of place. And I'm although I do understand that that these wines also are very limited in terms of let's say pleasurability. It's like the cello suites of Bach. You don't really put that music on to go shopping in a mall. It's it will creep into your mind, and it's so the same thing with these wines. They're not for every day and not for everyone. And so these wines, they had their let's say their logics and their sense of time. And without these wines, probably I would not have been able to make the wines I make today, which are much more precise, much more refined. And so it's I needed that to get to where I am now.
So maybe we could start by your telling me what you didn't want to make when you started. What was it that you didn't want to do in the beginning?
I did not like wood in wine. You have to... let's say the historical background, we're talking about end of the 90s, and we're talking about classic traditional Barolos being transformed into, let's say, Bordeaux influenced barrique and new barrique wines, vanilla and toasty oak in Nebbiolos, and which I loved, and I still greatly love this this area. The same, and I think with the Dominique Laurent wines in Burgundy, or I was not satisfied. I didn't really like those wines, because they gave me the impression that everything became very much the same, and dominated by either density, which was another thing I was not really fond of, and a marmalade-like style of wine. With a lot of oak over it, and so I had the impression as a wine passionate person, that the 90s, it was more about having hugely concentrated wines, going over the sense of place, and it was for me very hard to, drinking these wines, understanding where I was when I was tasting those wines. And so I preferred the wines of Henri Gouges, for example, which were a bit difficult when they were young, but beautiful in terms of where you are and when you taste the glass. I loved them. The old style Bruno Giacosas, the Montfortino, Montprivato, the Brunate from Rinaldi. Those wines, they gave me a sense of place and a great joy in tasting. And so my school is very classic in background, not only the French classic Bordeaux, and where also Bordeaux suffered from this and a big change in, but that started maybe already in the end of the 80s, but especially the 90s. Most of the Pouillacs and the Saint-Juliens, they started to become, let's say, Pomerols, and so everything. Let's say my wine world was starting to get blurred in terms of sense of space, and so I started with producing wines more with I want to make the absolute terroir wine, and for me that was liquid rock. And obviously I maybe made the same mistakes, and instead of using too much oak, I used too much oxygen, and so my wines, in a way, they started off and let's say overly evolved, and now my wines are much more precise, and the oxygen management is much better, and I see that in even Bordeaux, or now also Barolo, the use of wood is getting much less. So maybe the world is getting more more sensitive and sensible in a way, and so I think we all need to pass sometimes through either an excess of technology, and for me an excess of archaicness, and gradually we move into making wines with more respect and definition for territory, and less an producer or ego oriented, but much more, let's say, a nature and space oriented.
And what are some of the changes that you made besides lining the clay amphora to control the oxygen? What did you do to bring about the precision that you enjoy now?
It's difficult to pinpoint all the details, but my Japanese importer, he expresses it in a different way, like it's like a mountain of small, or let's say all small details, and make a mountain of an or create a mountain, and the mountain obviously is a big difference than a small hillside, and which makes the wines very different today than they are or than they used to be. But let's say practically our lids are covered today and during fermentation, which they were open with mosquito netting covered, but there was much more oxygen exchange in the old days than there is now. And now the CO2 during fermentation is a bit trapped in the vats, which gives a much better oxygen management. So there is the natural protection during fermentation, which doesn't oxidize the cap and the wine. That's number one. Number two is the racking is much is done in two phases, and but very very short after pressing. We do a first racking after we pressed. Let's say 3 or 4 days, we leave the wine to decant and for the reds, and then 7 days to 10 days for the white, and then we rack them, which means I don't have the gross lees during an élevage, but only the fine lees. That gives a more clean reaction on the wines, and so the wines are more focused, and they still have enough nourishment during élevage. And then during bottling, for example, we use argon, and is pulled out of the tank into the bottle is gradually filled up with argon. And so it's like putting a blanket over the wine, which gives you virtually no difference between the initial bottling and the last part of the bottling. So those are small things, but also, for example, when we rack or do pump overs, and we use a different technique to fill up the tubes first, and instead of using too much oxygen through the pumping to push the wine through, in some parts we use the CO2 in as pressure for the pump. To get the wine through the hoses instead of using the pump where you push, let's say, oxygen to behind the wine. In this case, we push CO2 behind the wine, and so it's a number of small details which makes a big difference.
At the same time that you've made changes in how you make the wine or how you interpret the wine, you've also expanded the vineyard area that you control. Yes. And how did that come about, and what is the extent of it?
It's not a quest for reaching let's say half a million bottles. That for me it's a matter of importance, and I started from zero, and so I need to build up a winery and with a certain seriousness in work where I can do selections. When I started with the half a hectare, it's hard to do a selection. You have to work with what you have, otherwise you don't make wine. And so already the second year, I had 2.5 hectares, which is already more comfortable because parts of the vineyards and the exposure is used for the top wine. Then a part of it doesn't get there, and so you don't throw away the grapes. And so you declassify them in a way into a second wine or in a base wine. Which has more sense because you're not going to cultivate, let's say, 10,000 kilos of grapes, throwing away 5,000 kilos and make only 5,000. I think that doesn't have any sense, and it's also waste. It doesn't feel right. It's nearly consumption oriented in a way. And so there's also respect for the land. It produces a certain amount, and so you want to also produce from the grapes which are not destined for your, let's say, your top wine or your best products. That is one. And so I needed more surface to make very good wines and also to reduce my yields. Second, I gradually noticed that Etna had a lot of different wines and wine expressions in the different areas. And so I gradually started to rent land and purchase and smaller plots in other areas which I liked. And the information came from local people who made their home wine. And as the winemaking technique from local people is relatively straightforward and simple, it gives a good sense of place, and it gives you an idea of how certain vineyards, express themselves compared to others in different locations, different altitudes. And so this gradually brought me to certain sites I like more than others. But obviously that is a very slow process, which has taken time. And so in 2003 and 4, I had 3 hectares. 2005, 2006, and we went to 5, and then 2008 and 2009 we had about 6.5, and then it grew exponential, and the last 3 years we went from 10, 11, and now we're at 18 hectares, and which is quite a lot. And now I feel I need to just stop for a moment, because it's better now to get everything perfectly aligned, the poles, the vineyards, well pruned. And once that is finished in 2 years, I will see whether I still have the urge whether I would like to buy another vineyard. What I will buy are great locations which are not planted yet. I have in property some 4 hectares, of which 3 hectares can be planted, and I think they're great locations, but that needs time. And so I need to choose. I'm 52 years old, and I physically and realistically have 20 or 25 harvests, which sounds for some people dramatic, but for me, I feel perfectly comfortable with that. It's just a reality. I can work physically until 70, 75 years old, but then you also have to be honest to yourself. I mean, you're not going to carry cases and do heavy work and like today, and that's just physically impossible. And so there will be land available for our children to choose whether they want to plant it or not. But I will always, if I have the chance, buy land and be great the positions to be able to plant it. That plantation will not be done in my life anymore, but that's going to be for our children. So eventually we will end up with maybe 30 hectares or 35, and then it's up to our children gradually to choose where they will plant or where they or maybe even sell it. That will be entirely up to them, and that's not in my hands anymore, but at least the possibility will be there.
Is your dad still alive?
Yes, he is, and then also my mother. They're very healthy, and so I'm very happy for that. But I'm also a bit concerned. They have a certain age, and so it's nice that they come once in a while to me, and then I go and visit them, and, because it's I don't know, for my father it's something special also. It's an as a wine collector, obviously producing wine, it's a big jump, and it's but it's nice to see that things go well, and so he's very happy for me.
Did seeing your dad get a bit older lend itself to your own impression of impermanence and the 2025 vintage idea that maybe you wouldn't be around forever?
You know, we never talk about these things, but I think he understands perfectly what is going on in my mind. And it's something funny between father and son. Usually one never speaks about this, but I think I kind of feel what he's thinking, and I think it's a mutual thing.
And how did you meet your wife?
Aki, she visited me in 2006 because she read an article about my way of cultivating. I prefer the non-tillage and philosophy of Fukuoka compared to the constant tilling. And and so she visited me, and we stayed in touch over 6 and more months. She came back, and then in the end she stayed on Etna,
because she's Japanese, and Fukuoka was also a Japanese farmer and philosopher.
I think basically, and she read about my wines, and because my wines are let's say well represented in Japan in a way that Japan was my first customer, my first and overall, and not only my biggest in the first years, but and so in Japan, and there's many of my first vintages, and so it's there's more in a way more information in Japan from where I started and to what I'm doing now. Let's say the historical and let's say the history of my wine and winemaking and nearly is more represented in Japan than it is in other places of the world.
You told me once that France was your biggest market, which I found very surprising.
It is, and not in the beginning. It has become today, and let's say since 2 years, it's become the biggest market and for my wines. But France, you have to. You have to analyze this in a different way. It's obviously Paris, which takes 80%. It's a bit like when you talk about wine, obviously New York takes, consumes and absorbs a lot of wine. And So, but in France, my wines are also in shops in Bonn, in Lyon, in Marseille, and so it's not only even in Reims. So it's not only Paris, but obviously Paris absorbs and a lot of my wine, but not only from me, and also for most other wineries. And so it's very satisfying. Because it's not that in France it lacks wine. They have a great culture, and so who needs wines from Etna in a way? But they seem to have something special for them, and I think this edge, this territorial identity, the tension in the wine, for them it's those are special wines, which. For me, is very very special to sell a lot of wine in France.
We think of Etna as kind of one thing here in the States. Are you in a particular part of it, and who's next to you?
Very good question. Because Etna has, let's say, four known sites. The eastern side, which is known for the white wines, which is close to the sea. Is relatively humid, and the red wines, the Nerello Mascalese, does not always get to perfect ripeness. The great Etna wines today, from Marco de Grazia, Terre Nere, from Passo Pisciaro Estate, Giuseppe Russo or Gracci, we all are in the same northern valley. Partly by strange coincidence, I started in 2001. And also Andrea Franchetti from Passo Pisciaro, he started in 2001. Neither of us knew that we were there. But strange enough, we started both in the Solicchiata area. So Marco De Grazia in 2002, he started in closer to Randazzo in the area, mainly in Calderara. Giuseppe Russo, and he was in Passo Pisciaro, and Alberto Aiello from the Gracci estate, he settled also in Passo Pisciaro. So we're basically all in that same area. And now, when we're talking about the Etna wines, especially the red wines, we're talking about the Northern Valley, which has become a bit like the Côte de Nuit of Etna. All the top wines are come from that area.
You said that a local had taught you about pruning.
Yes.
How much local knowledge was there in Etna when you arrived, or was it a lot of your own discovery or combination of the two?
Let's say a combination of the two. And the knowledge for the vine, the vine growing, the culture around planting a vineyard for the next generation is something very specific to Etna. Because a vineyard was planted not only for yourself but mainly for to last for generations, and so the vine and the cure, the attention, the sensitivity, and the work for the vines are just unbelievable. Otherwise, I would not be able to work today with 100-year-old vines. I mean, my youngest vineyard is 50 years old. Those are my so-called jeune vigne, which is unbelievable. I work with them with a heritage and from generations ago, which makes me many times when I prune the vines, and it makes me feel very humble, and it's very special to be able to work with those vines. If we talk about the wines, then I must say there is very little culture in let's say ancient or old style winemaking. Also because the old style winemaking was based on very short skin contact. It was much more a sense of as soon as possible, let's get the wine in, let's mutate it, let's put it in a barrel, and then off we go, and we can go and work in the vineyards again. Basically, that was nearly it. So the attention to detail in the cellar was virtually non-existent. And so there was 48-hour skin contact, and there was a little attention to how to crush the grapes. The destemming was not done, not because people didn't want to, but because only the rich people had a destemmer. And so I found old destemmers and with a hand wheel, and but that was only for rich and bigger estates. So I think Etna Wines. I think that the value of Etna Wines has been built up since let's say when I arrived, and together with Andrea, with Marco, and we were the first three of, and they called us the Renaissance of Etna. And so I'm also, that is a very special thing to be able to be part of the Renaissance of Etna. Both of the, all three of us have our own very specific technique in winemaking, but all three of us, I think, have contributed to putting Etna back on the map of great winemaking areas, where, let's say, the local producers haven't been able to do that. But the one thing is sure, we are able to do this and to produce these wines. We are able to, let's say, we have been able to establish start the Renaissance of Etna because of what has been planted generations before we arrived there. And so I call this it's a beautiful symbiosis where, let's say, the prior generations have, let's say, passed on to us their great and beautifully planted vineyards, which I think today we are unable to maintain and to plant like those people did. And so I'm just eternally grateful that I've been able to buy, and I'm renting those vineyards, and because planting these yourself, building stone walls, is just an I don't know, it's a heroic and work of with nature, and it's just impressive.
What about Nerello Mascalese? Where do you think it came from? How did it end up in Etna? And what's it like as a grape variety?
The origin of Nerello Mascalese, I'm not completely sure of. It's supposed to come over Greece and to Etna. Obviously, it started at the port, where usually most of the exchanges are start and have an initiation. The Nerello Mascalese basically comes from Negrello Mascalese. It's like the black grape varietal, which has been planted in Mascali, and Mascali is the highest located village above Riposto Giare, where the harbor used to be, where the ships were leaving to bring the wine out the bulk wine to ship it to different countries. And so the first Nerello was planted in Mascali on the eastern side of the mountain. From there, it has expanded both to, let's say, the southern part of the mountain and beyond Catania, relatively high up. And the last valley which had been planted was the northern valley, because of the inaccessibility. There were no roads in 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and so those roads had been gradually built because of the wine planting. And in the 70s, 80s, and partly because of the phylloxera devastation on Etna, a part of the vineyards were still remained and were not damaged. And so there was a boom in interest, not because of Etna, but because that was one of the few places where there was wine available. And so there has been a blossoming and then of economy, which afterwards has gone, let's say, has been lost in the 80s, and there was the, also Bordeaux suffered in the 80s, and the prices, and Etna has, and, has gone through the same crisis, especially Etna, because the wines were never sold with a label, and so the wine was, let's say, blended either into an Piemonte wines or in an, in wines from Burgundy even. So it's which answers your the second part of your question. It is fascinating to see that even in the old days, and Etna was appreciated, I think, by those areas because there was a similarity between either and Nebbiolo and Pinot, depending on the vineyard, and the vineyards could be more, let's say, tannin driven, like in which I recognize in the area of Solicchiata, whereas in Passo Pisciaro on the higher slopes you have a more Pinotish character in the wines, and it's an which, let's say, is confirmed in let's say with the true history of Nerello, where it has been sold.
Sometimes I open up a bottle that's Nerello Mascalese or mostly Nerello Mascalese, and I drink it young and I think to myself, boy, this could age like a Burgundy. This tastes like a Burgundy, or this tastes like a certain kind of Barolo. This could age that well. Does it age that well? Have you opened up bottles that have medium length, you know, at 10 years, or ageability at 20 years or 30 years? Have you had examples that have aged on the same kind of curve that you associate with Burgundy or Nebbiolo?
I can relate to two examples. I had more, but you have to know that the wines on Etna were not really bottled, and so it's difficult to find Etna wines as such. So there are a few wines, but I'm not sure whether that was pure Nerello. I think they were partly blended with maybe wines from Nero d'Avola, from Pacchino, or from the Victoria area. And it's because they were a bit too sweet, and I'm over because the wines we're talking about 74, and one bottle was 85, and that was definitely Nerello. So the 74, I leave it, and there's a shadow of doubt in that bottle. But a part of it will definitely, it has been Nerello, and it had a distinct character and to it, a beautiful elegance, and but the color, and there was a bit too much sweetness in the palate to be, I think, a 100% Nerello wine. The other bottle was from the Murgo estate, Tenuta San Michele Murgo, was 85, and it was they used to bottle in a Burgundy bottle. And I remember that we were tasting the wine with the family, and it left me, really it touched me, that wine. It was not a complex wine. It was not the most profound wine, and but it had a beautiful and elegance to it, like an old Burgundy. It was not a super concentrated vintage, but it had aged really distinctively well. It had a noble tannin to it, and it just was an it was in 2002 that we opened it. It was the second year I was on Etna, and I complimented the father and Michele Scamacca for this, because then it's rare to find older bottles, and it was just a fun. I thought it was a fantastic wine. Not perfection, but it was something that that gave me the idea that Nerello was really age worthy, and so it's up to us now to prove that Etna wines can age and then reach also that fantastic complexity and profoundness that maybe lacked in those days because of too high yields and because of maybe lack of culture in those days. But let's say, I think the vehicle is there to show greater war wines.
What is the character of Nerello in terms of a grape that you pick, harvest, and then use? It seems to have lighter color. It seems to have tannins, but not firm tannins. What do you think about it? I mean, I'm just my own experience, but
well, it depends on the vintage, and it's not to avoid a question or to give a let's say nebulous answer, but Nerello on Etna, especially in the Northern Valley, is subject to all, let's say, the positive and the negative influences of a southern area, as well as all the positive and negative influences and the characteristics of a northern area, which means we have hail blasts, we have cold winters, we have sometimes too hot summers. And so the vintage differences on Etna are enormous. I mean, I personally don't know any other winemaking area that has such extreme vintage characteristics. Now, if I take 2012 as a vintage, there is such a phenolic ripeness and such a density, such a tannic structure, that it's unbelievable. And we come close to Nebbiolo with this vintage. If I go back to 2010, and it is a very light and nearly no phenolic ripeness, and especially in the high vineyards, and extremely light, extremely elegant wines, they nearly remind me of a Pulsar or a Jura, a red wine. And so we're talking about the same vineyard and having an extreme difference in presenting itself. And we're not saying those wines, when I talk about these and these wines, I talk about these wines when you go the absolute stretch to pick as late as possible, to clean out the berries with monks and patience and precision, and to keep them as long as possible. Not just to pick unripe, but really Etna is also that. It's a place where the extremes touch each other, and that's why I think it's intriguing, and especially for me, I love alpine climbing. I like the outdoors, and it's a challenge. Every vintage is a challenge. It's different. Every vintage, you have to invent something else. You have to anticipate some things. You have to react in different ways. And so this is the 13th vintage, and they have all been different.
Sometimes I've wondered, as a sommelier, how I should go about opening and serving your wines of different ones. It seemed in the past that there was more sediment in the bottles, and I wasn't sure how soon or if at all I should decant it off the sediment. It seems now that there's less. Maybe you could tell me, going through the different wines that you produce, when I might start thinking about opening them. Obviously, there's, as you said, huge differences in vintage, but sometimes you blend those vintages together. So what should I be thinking about, and how should I be opening them, and should I be decanting them? And if I should be decanting them, how far ahead should I be decanting them?
It's a question of where to start. Let's start with the older and let's say the first generation and wines. As those wines were highly evolved by vinification, by choice of vinification, they also had a lot of sediment, as you rightly expressed. I feel that the wine should be separated from the sediment to start with. And today in, let's say, the natural wine and commune, and it's let's say, fashionable to shake up bottles and drink the sediment. I'm very sorry, but I'm educated a little bit too classic, and so I prefer the sediment to be separated. Afterwards, I drink the sediment because it's very nourishing, and it's also represent all the density in the wine, and so I prefer to drink that separate. And it's something we always we've always done at home, but especially in Italy with the old Barolos, the last glass of the bottle, I always prefer to drink that and completely separate myself, because it is the densest glass, but also the less precise. So in the case of my wines, the first wines, I would not decant, because otherwise the decanting it takes away a part of the first very light and reductive flavors, which I love. And so I would suggest to first take the glasses, separate, like in Burgundy, and then what people used to do in the cellars, they take a bottle, six glasses, and then you pour out the complete bottle, and you take the sediment out without decanting. You just, let's say you decant it into the glasses directly. And that, I think, is a beautiful way for my wines too. And then you have from the first smell, you notice a little bit the reductive sides. Then they open up with the oxygen. They change gradually, and they evolve always in the glass. If you would decant, a big part is, let's say, taken away. Now, if you don't gradually go to the newer vintages, which are bottled a bit earlier, they also have less oxygen during the complete vinification élevage process, I would suggest when they are let's say less than 2 years old, I would decant them. Very slowly, not an hour before, but let's say just before drinking, and separate the sediment and from the bottle, if there is any, and then serve it so that at least it can open up a little bit more, less for the reduction, but more give the wine a bit more expansion, because they as the last two vintages also have been quite compact and very concentrated. I think, or I feel at least, they need a bit more oxygen to open up, because otherwise, I don't know, they're much more tannin accentuated and less generous and like my wines, let's say, used to be, and from the, let's say, the first generation of vinification. But that's those are two different approaches. So I'm always cautious with decanting. I'm not a fan of it. But if the wines are young, then I would say decant. Otherwise, I would serve them in the bigger glasses.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about some of the farming. You lay in buckwheat for a few years while the vineyard is fallow when you're about to plant. Why might you do that?
Buckwheat has a special quality, which is it gives the energy to the land without taking energy. And there are certain herbs or beans that give nitrogen to the soil, but nitrogen gives, let's say, an immediate boost of energy. It's like sugar in your body. Afterwards, once the sugar is burned, your body feels like it gets into a sugar need, and so you have nearly a negative drop off in energy. So first you get an excessive injection of energy, and afterwards you go below your energy level. And so I prefer the land and not to do this, and then I give a little bit extra, say growing buckwheat, and we don't use it, we just cut it, and it decomposes, and we leave it like that for at least 1 year, preferably 2 years before planting. In that way, the soil doesn't get rich in terms of being able to give a lot of crop, but it decomposes, and it gives you back relatively fast a minimum layer of organic material. Buckwheat is something and something quite special. Without, let's say, the sugar is the best way to express it. Without, let's say, over sugaring your land or your body, and which afterwards will drop into a negative phase, where either your land or what you plant afterwards will need too much water to get over that phase again. So I don't want to drug my my land, but I want to gradually help it to get to its own balance again, and that's also the philosophy of my cultivating. That is why I prefer Fukuoka, the non-tillage, if possible, to go that way instead of the constant spraying, and even if it's biodynamic, because I do not believe that land, a vineyard, and a cultivation needs every year the same spraying. It would be like an like us living in a hospital every and being protected. And I think when we're healthy, we just get out of the hospital and we live until maybe there is an accident or we get sick, and then you search for the best appropriate medication to get healthy again. And so I like biodynamics as a cure, but not as a way of cultivating. And that is why I think the Fukuoka approach, the non-tillage, the permaculture, is much more interesting and much more valuable, because it's the search for healthy land and a healthy, let's say, crop and a healthy ecosystem, which is, let's say, self-sustainable, literally, without the help of man, with treatments, with added nourishment, etc. So that is the ultimate goal, which is, to be honest, very difficult. And I've tried to balance this out, but in 2007, to give you a very simple fact which happened, and one of my vineyards nearly was wiped out with a bushfire, because the shepherds, they set fire in the south and so that herbs for their sheep grows right after the summer period. But if that gets out of hand and you have grass in your vineyards, it catches fire. And so many times we have to wheel through it to avoid a bushfire to just burn your whole vineyard. And so you see, working the land, there is the theoretical approach, and then there's the practical situations which have nothing to do with agriculture, but obviously you're not gonna let's say, let your vineyard, which is 100 years old vines, and get burnt just because of the sake of your own philosophy. And so this is only one example where you have to make a compromise.
Because it's the kind of soil, it's volcanic soil, so there's not a lot of vegetative growth. So they probably just set the fires thinking they'll go out on their own once the grass is gone.
Yeah, it's they literally set fire to grow, to just let it grow again. And so they don't really care. It's something that people have done since generations, and I can understand this, but it depends also the sensitivity of the shepherds. And it's not only shepherds, there's also pyromaniacs, there's problems with other people. For some mushrooms, they grow after a fire in some places. And so it's a combination of many different things, and which is let's say, in your part of that society, this culture, and so you just have to make sure that you survive in this this, let's say, in these circumstances. And so we have, for example, a vineyard at Monte Colla, where we have a shepherd right next to it, and he's an incredibly sensitive person, and so he actually helps us burn around the vineyards, and so that we can leave the grass in the vineyard, and so we don't have any problems. But I mean, that's an exception to the rule. But it is possible. But you need also the sensitivity from other people who are living around you. And so I'm not against shepherds, but I know they have a need for survival. And so do we. And so if both of us understand each other, then you can come to a good agreement. But it's not always easy.
This may be a very simplistic formulation of this question, but you tend to use very little sulfur in terms of the vineyard, and then basically none in the winery. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we hear that active volcanoes are a source of sulfur, and you grow vines on an active volcano.
Yeah.
Is there sulfur already in the soil?
No, there's no sulfur in the soil. And there is sulfur in soil where there is like a mine of sulfur, like in Campania. There are a few examples of vineyards grown on land where below there is sulfur mines, and they have a very different sulfuric and flavors. our wines, they have as a characteristic a more smokiness, and which also comes from lava soil, but hasn't got anything to do with the sulfur. The sulfur, which let's say is in the air, because there is always fumes and gas coming out of Etna. It's an active volcano, literally. Like every month, there's always an eruption. It settles around the cone of Etna, but then it's obviously taken away by an by the wind to, let's say, different areas. As we are in the northern valley, and the winds in our area are much more on let's say west and east oriented, we rarely get the let's say the fumes inside of the valley, also because they're taken away up higher because of the warmth. And so the influence of possible sulfur in the air, I think it is extremely it's negligible. So the sulfur issue and in the soil is non-existent, also because we're a lava soil. And if there would be sulfur, it would have been burnt and within the lava, the sulfur itself, because lava is around 1,000 degrees centigrade. And so if there would be sulfur in it, it's already evaporated in within the rock itself. There would not be even sediment anymore. So there's the only possibility is in through the air, and which, yes, there will be something, but it's of such negligible and quantity that it's a non-existing issue, I think.
At some point, you introduced a rosé. When was that, and how is it different, and how would you approach it different than your other wines? How do you think about it in relation to the reds?
Yes, the rosé is an interesting and story, but also a very simplistic one. I've never thought about making a rosé. That was never, let's say, planned, neither on my list or on. I had a plot, and I still have that plot in Lies, which contains Cataratto grapes, which are destined for the white. And there was a part of Malvasia. The Malvasia is a grape variety I don't really like, as an I don't like aromatic varietals in a dry red wine. And so the owner was very pleased, because I maintained his lines of Malvasia, and he made his own home wine, and I took the Cataratto, and so everybody happy until 2007, where he came back to me and said, like, well, you just have to also take the Malvasia, because I can't drink wine anymore. So I said, like, well, shoot, what am I going to do with this Malvasia? It's like, sell it? Well, doesn't make any sense. And then it's like, well, I asked a few friends, like, and somebody told me, an older person, well, you make rosé, it's, and then you put some Nerello in it. And I said, like, well, that's maybe not a bad idea. And so by total chance and coincidence, I ended up with this Malvasia. And I said, well, if I make a rosé, then it shouldn't be, let's say, red grapes and direct press, but it should be the same philosophy. So, like, I need to find the right balance between the white grapes and the red grapes. And so I did a bit of a test with squeezing and with assembling the wines to check out percentages. And I came with some kind of formula in percentages. And I tried the first one, and it was, it was a strike in a sense that it was a very pleasurable wine. It was nice to drink. It had aromatics, not too much. It had a tannin touch, but not too much. So it was a rosé with personality, with a hinge of smokiness again, where you can find Etna also in it, and then a very vin de soif, and like the French call it, and it's great for drinking without too many thinking. And so I had a great summer wine.
And what about the olive oil? It seems like you've thought it through a great deal.
Yes, the olive oil is an is very special because it's part of the trilogy of cultivating in the Mediterranean, which means wine, the olives and cereals, and those are the three cultivations which are, let's say, possible to combine in terms of the work you have. The cereals usually are harvested and around August, and then you have your harvest of your grapes, you make your wine, and then afterwards you do your olive oil, your olives, and so you finish your cultivating year, and you can start with the winter works. And you need the cereals to live off. The wine was for selling, and the olive oil was for sharing it with friends and to use in the kitchen. So it had a perfect logic. And so when I first came there, I was not only attracted to the wine, but I especially was attracted also with the olives. And so I started to check out which olives and the small ones. And I fell in love with the taste of San Benedetto, which has also this characteristic smokiness. And when I first made it in 2002, and it was extremely refined. The yields were very low, but there was an elegance which I also appreciated. And I found a resemblance nearly in the Tagiasche and olive oils from Liguria. And I got more and more not obsessed, but really focused and drawn to producing olive oils with the same quality level as the wines. And so today we have three different levels of olive oil: the Contadino, Mungibel, and the Magma, which is the top olive oil from one selected plot, only if it's ripe and then when we get everything right. And so we produce them exactly to the same standards.
Has the fame surprised you that you and your wines have encountered in the international markets?
Yes, to be honest, and yes, because you don't expect that. And I didn't start making wines for fame. I just started to make wines because I was attracted by wine and I like it. And so the fame is if you can call it that way, everything's relative. But let's say the recognition for what I'm doing is very nice. It it stimulates you when I come back home I can come to different places. The wines are appreciated and I can exchange with different cultures about a product from which has a territorial sense, and I can think about how people react, what they think, and we are talking now also in this interview. Tomorrow when I wake up, there are questions, there are some things that I will maybe I can use to improve my wines. And so for me, that cultural exchange and let's say that cultural appreciation for what I'm doing is as much important as the products I make. So it's not like a one direction and activity. There's also a return. Like I produce this, it gets appreciated or not, and people have a question, they do not like it, and I can explain why I produce wines in a certain way. And so I don't accept people to always like what I produce. And so it's that exchange that makes me grow and makes me also makes my products get better, but also makes me a more complete person in the end. So it's a very special product I'm making, because it's impossible to have this exchange with potatoes or with carrots, and wine has this incredible dynamic and this incredible cultural baggage which stimulates me in the end also as a producer. So it's like nearly a perpetuum mobile which goes on and on, and I think it can only, and my wines will only get better as long as I remain sensitive to and open-minded for criticism, and positive and negative.
Frank Cornelison, he's going on and on in Aetna. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Levy.
Hey, everyone. We love your feedback, and we'd love to see your feedback in the comments section on iTunes. I know you want to tell us what you thought about today's episode. We'll see you there.
I'm Molly from Public Restaurant, and I use 750 all the time. It has all of the information I could possibly need. It makes my life so much easier, and it's one of the best reference tools I have. I love 750.com.
And that's this week's episode of I'll Drink to That. You can find the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening.